So welcome back. We're again in the first chapter of the second book titled Indeterminates, Cosmic Determinations and the Indeterminable. Sri Aurobindo has been describing how the power of Chit Shakti is reflected even in the mechanical powers emerging from the inconscience at the basis of the cosmos, and that there are oppositionally two principles, one of the free variation of possibles, which are accorded to the infinite, resulting in chance, and another, the principle of real powers of truth fulfilling themselves necessarily. So, indeterminism versus determinism. And he continues now. All the unexplained processes of nature would find their meaning and their place if this hypothesis proved to be tenable. Energy seems to create substance, but in reality, as existence is inherent in consciousness force, so also substance would be inherent in energy. The energy, a manifestation of the force, substance, a manifestation of the secret existence. So, this arises from the omnipresent reality of Satchitananda. Existence and consciousness are coextensive. They're not different from each other. So wherever you have one, the other must be there, impliedly, if not overtly. And just as we love that revelation that Einstein brought us, that energy and matter are not different, but different forms of the same thing. So whenever you find consciousness force, substance must be implied in that. And wherever you find substance, consciousness must be implied. So there can be no substance without inhering consciousness, and there can be no doubt that the universe thus is not a field of inconscience. It is not nescience. It is not fully lapsed out of light into darkness. It appears to be dark. It appears to be blank at its beginning. The inconscience appears to be impenetrable. So dark is it, and yet the light of consciousness must be present. He continues, but as it is a spiritual substance, it would not be apprehended by the material sense until it is given by energy the forms of matter seizable by that sense. One begins to understand also how arrangement of design, quantity, and number can be a base for the manifestation of quality and property. For design, quantity, and number are powers of existence substance. Quality and property are powers of the consciousness and its force that reside in the existence. They can then be made manifest and operative by a rhythm and process of substance. There's an echo in here, of course, of the Vedantic idea of nama and rupa, name and form going into the shaping of what is the real being. And now we move back into Platonism. The growth of the tree out of the seed would be accounted for, like all other similar phenomena, by the indwelling presence of what we have called the real idea, the infinite's self-perception of the significant form, the living body of its power of existence that has to emerge from its own self-compression in energy substance, would be carried internally in the form of the seed, carried in the occult consciousness, involved in that form, and would naturally evolve out of it. There's a great deal there. Remember what Sri Aurobindo has defined as the real idea. It is not a lofty insubstantial conception, but it is a conceptive power of the truth consciousness. What it sees, what it envisages, has real force behind it, has real substance in it. And so it is an idea of reality. So when we look at a tree that grows out of the seed, it is because, Sri Aurobindo says, it contains that real idea. Now, Plato would say that the ideas are above and are reflected here in matter. That is not Sri Aurobindo's view, but the idea, the image of the tree coming from the seed, is useful to him as an analogy as well. But the seed here contains the power of the truth that conceived it. Here, in matter, not simply above, it's not simply a reflection, it is stationed in matter. The real idea is present within. That suggests that the divine presence, as an immense Satchit Ananda, is not absent from any corner of the universe, but it also suggests that its organizing principle of consciousness, the supermind, is present in every material being. All that is substantial, all that is formed, carries inherently this conscious power as a constellating, organizing, harmonizing expression of itself within. It is contained within. He also says, interestingly, that it's the infinite's self-perception of the significant form. Now, those of you who have studied the philosophy of art will recognize that this is a famous expression by Clive Bell in his 1914 book, Art. He grasped this idea of significant form to say this is why we like something. The form signifies. It has meaning. It has impact. And that is why some forms of art don't appeal to us. It is a construction of the mind. It is a construction of vitality, but it doesn't grasp us. And others do, whether in music or painting or the formation of poetry. When it occupies a form that signifies something greater behind it, then, there is an alignment, there is that experience of aesthesis, and we have a rapturous unity with the experience of beauty. Beauty is truth measuring itself out in form, and it influences you. So the idea of the infinite self-perception of the significant form, he's talking about here how the infinite encloses itself, wraps itself up in this idea of the real idea, and it is a significant form. The living body of its power of existence that has to emerge from its own self-compression in energy substance. There again, the idea that all of this reality is telescoped into this significant form, in a seed form that must release its power in the process of evolution and express itself mightily in the cosmos, would be carried internally in the form of the seed. There it is, carried in the occult. Occult means hidden. Carried in the hidden consciousness involved in that form, and would naturally evolve out of it. So we look at the form. We must descry with penetrating vision what it is that is essential to it. What is this form about? What does it want to express? There would be no difficulty either in understanding on this principle how infinitesimals of a material character like the gene and the chromosome can carry in them psychological elements to be transmitted to the physical form that has to emerge from the human seed. Now, he's not delving into the chemical expression of what those things are, but what he's saying is that there's an inner power that expresses itself necessarily in the form that eventuates in this thing that we see before us. It would be, at bottom, on the same principle in the objectivity of matter as that which we find in our subjective experience. For we see that the subconscious physical carries in it a mental, psychological content, impressions of past events, habits, fixed mental and vital formations, fixed forms of character, and sends them up by an occult process to the waking consciousness, thus originating or influencing many activities of our nature. So the material form contains a psychological content and can and does release it upwards into our nature and becomes active. Whether we're aware of its sourcing or not, these powers are active, enclosed in the body, enclosed in matter. On the same basis, he says, there would be no difficulty in understanding why the physiological functionings of the body help to determine the mind's psychological actions. For the body is not mere unconscious matter. It is a structure of a secretly conscious energy that has taken form in it. Itself occultly conscious, it is, at the same time, the vehicle of expression of an overt consciousness that has emerged and is self-aware in our physical energy substance. So we can see then that there's a conscious energy behind that forms this vessel through which it wishes to manifest. Again, the inner expresses the outer. The body's functionings are a necessary machinery or instrumentation for the movements of this mental inhabitant. It is only by setting the corporeal instrument in motion that the conscious being emerging, evolving in it, can transmit its mind formations, will formations, and turn them into a physical manifestation of itself in matter. The capacity, the processes of the instrument must, to a certain extent, reshape the mind formations and their transition from mental shape into physical expression. Its workings are necessary and must exercise their influence before that expression can become actual. So, simply put, the body is a necessary instrument for the evolution to occur in the physical world. Otherwise, bluntly, the world purpose would be blunted. The bodily instrument may, even in some directions, dominate its user. It may, too, by a force of habit, suggest or create involuntary reactions of the consciousness inhabiting it before the waking mind and will can control or interfere. So this is the other side of it. If we've been talking about how the inner being or the consciousness can influence and direct and form and shape and manifest its material vehicle, so too the body may impact the consciousness, yes? All this is possible because the body has a, quote, subconscient consciousness of its own, which counts in our total self-expression. Even if we look at this outer instrumentation only, we can conclude that body determines mind. But this is only a minor truth, and the major truth is that mind determines body. So, the first view, as we look at how the life expression dominated by physicality seems to enchain mind, we would say that it is the body that determines the mind. But Sri Aurobindo says, no, when we see it from the larger perspective, the larger truth is that mind determines the body. In this view, a still deeper truth becomes conceivable, a spiritual entity ensouling the substance that veils it, is the original determinant of both mind and body. So whether we're arguing about whether it's the mind that is the leader or the body that is the leader, he suggests that behind there is a spiritual entity, a soul, ensouling the substance, spiritual entity that moves into and directs from behind both mind and body. So mind is not the seat of self. It is a figuring of the self, just as the body is a shaping of the self. On the other side, in the opposite order of process, that by which the mind can transmit its ideas and commands to the body can train it to be an instrument for new action, can even so impress it with its habitual demands or orders that the physical instinct carries them out automatically even when the mind is no longer consciously willing them. Those also more unusual, but well attested, by which, to an extraordinary and hardly limitable extent, the mind can learn to determine the reactions of the body, even to the overriding of its normal law or conditions of action. These and other otherwise unaccountable aspects of the relation between these two elements of our being become easily understandable, for it is the secret consciousness in the living matter that receives from its greater companion. Again, we refer often to Sri Aurobindo's work in the field of yoga, and what he's writing here was developed as a knowledge from years of practical experience of bringing powers of consciousness into the physique and arranging and determining empowerments and extensions of power through the body that affected and influenced beings and climate and events over and over again. We must not think that Sri Aurobindo sat in a room and did nothing. Sri Aurobindo was forcefully engaged in life, but he did it quietly from that asana inside the ashram. A secret consciousness in the living matter that receives from its greater companion. It is this in the body that, in its own involved and occult fashion, perceives or feels the demand on it and obeys the emerged or evolved consciousness which presides over the body. Well, we're going to get very quickly to this idea of the conscious soul, the purusha, influencing the vehicle, prakriti. Here it's only a suggestion. He'll deal with it directly in just a page or two. Finally, the conception of a divine mind and will creating the cosmos becomes justifiable, while at the same time the perplexing elements in it which our reasoning mentality refuses to ascribe to an arbitrary fiat of the Creator find their explanation as inevitable phenomena of a consciousness emerging with difficulty out of its opposite, but with the mission to override these contrary phenomena and manifest by a slow and difficult evolution its greater reality and true nature. So if consciousness seems to be at the beck and call of brute material nature at the beginning, there is a purpose in it, and it is that it must inevitably reveal its inherent powers, its various stadia of conscious being in this slow and difficult evolution. Because thus it reveals its true reality. But an approach from the material end of existence cannot give us any certitude of validity for this hypothesis, or for that matter, for any other explanation of nature and her procedure. The veil cast by the original inconscience is too thick for the mind to pierce, and it is behind this veil that is hidden the secret origination of what is manifested. There are seated the truths and powers underlying the phenomena and processes that appear to us in the material front of nature. So that veil, do you remember when he was talking about the veil above that separates the supermind and the, or there's a transparent veil at the top of the supermental nature that in a sense leans back or opens up to Satchitananda. And then there's another veil where the overmind diversifies itself and pours itself into the manifestation of the world that we know, mind, life, and body. And that is that golden lid. And we have to get beyond it to be able to seize the truth of things. There is another veil, and this is at the basis of the universe. Below that veil, we can penetrate and rediscover the secret conscious reality that is always there, but the inconscient, in a sense, hides it from us. That veil prevents us from knowing it at its root. And as he says, to know with greater certitude, we must follow the curve of evolving consciousness until it arrives at a height and largeness of self-enlightenment in which the primal secret is self-discovered. For presumably, it must evolve, must eventually bring out what was held from the beginning by the occult original consciousness in things of which it is a gradual manifestation. So there he's touched upon it. We have to have a very high consciousness. We must get back to the secret of things above to be able to dive down and penetrate what is below. The superconscient opens the inconscient to our investigation. It's by growing our consciousness upwards, first inwards, then upwards, and then by diving down into matter and below matter into the inconscient that we can arrive at the solution. What is there? But on the way, we're also enlarging our being. It's not simply a matter of going high and down. It's not vertical and it's not a vertical ascent and a descending into the inconscient that's required, but also a totalizing, a globalizing, a universalizing of our consciousness. We have to enlarge. Self-enlightenment is not simply knowing our being as the essence, but also as the all. We must have the highest consciousness in order to dive into the penetralia of the universe, but we must, in a sense, hold the universe in ourselves as we achieve this. So growing our consciousness, ascending, means enlarging. We can't really get back to the superconscient origins of things without universalizing our awareness. The personal must become universal as it becomes transcendent. But here he's describing how mind is incapable of knowing what is at the root of matter. But he continues and says, in life, it would be clearly hopeless to seek for the truth, for life begins with a formulation in which consciousness is still submental, and therefore to us as mental beings appears as inconscient or at most subconscious. And our own investigation into this stage of life, studying it from outside, cannot be more fruitful of the secret truth than our examination of matter. So if mind is incapable of really understanding matter at its roots, it would be fruitless for us to look in the level of the life for the solution. It won't get any better answer there. Even when mind develops in life, he says, its first functional aspect is a mentality involved in action, in vital and physical needs and preoccupations, in impulses, desires, sensations, emotions, unable to stand back from these things and observe and know them. So mind has not the capacity to penetrate any of these. It cannot know itself. It cannot know the secret of life. It cannot know the secret of matter. In the human mind, there is the first hope of understanding, discovery, of free comprehension. Here we might seem to be coming to the possibility of self-knowledge and world knowledge, but in fact, our mind can at first only observe facts and processes, and for the rest, it has to make deductions and inferences, to construct hypotheses, to reason, to speculate. In order to discover the secret of consciousness, it would have to know itself and determine the reality of its own being and process. But as in animal life, the emerging consciousness is involved in vital action and movement, so in the human being, mind consciousness is involved in its own whirl of thoughts, an activity in which it is carried on without rest and in which its very reasonings and speculations are determined in their tendency, trend, conditions by its own temperament, mental turn, past formation and line of energy, inclination, preference, and inborn natural selection. We do not freely determine our thinking according to the truth of things. It is determined for us by our nature. We can indeed stand back with a certain detachment and observe the workings of the mental energy in us, but it is still only its process that we see, and not any original source of our mental determinations. We can build theories and hypotheses of the process of mind, but a veil is still there over the inner secret of ourselves, our consciousness, our total nature. We stand outside as observers and we describe what we see, and what we see is the process. We are not masters of knowledge because, again, knowledge comes through identity, and mind knows by the separation of subject from object. It has an inherent incapacity to know the all and the whole. It cannot entertain all perspectives. It can see by perspective, but cannot contain the whole of what is vision. It is only when we follow the yogic process of quieting the mind itself that a profounder result of our self-observation becomes possible. So when we silence the mind, then we begin to come to knowledge. For first, we discover that mind is a subtle substance, a general determinate or generic indeterminate, which mental energy, when it operates, throws into forms or particular determinations of itself, thoughts, concepts, percepts, mental sentiments, activities of will and reactions of feeling, but which, when the energy is quiescent, can live either in an inert torpor or in an immobile silence and peace of self-existence. So this substance of mind can, in a sense, generally determine itself or be like a sea of stuff from which this homogeneous mind stuff, things can be determined, but itself be an indeterminate. So then this mental energy is thrown into forms. Remember, energy and substantiation of energy is the realization of form. So mental substance is as real as physical substance and is also twinned with energy, but here it is a mental energy. So if we still the mind, then we can either fall into a torpor or and a mobile silence and have a look at this mind stuff and see it. Next, he writes, we see that the determinations of our mind do not all proceed from itself, for waves and currents of mental energy enter into it from outside. So this, again, is the witness consciousness watching the mind stuff and seeing that mentation, all the activities of the mind, thinking, ideas, floats across our vision, and we are observing it. This, of course, was Sri Aurobindo's first realization when he sat in Baroda on the roof and was told to look and observe his consciousness, and he would see that thoughts would come into him from outside, and he was directed to stop those thoughts, and he did, and his mind fell into a silence, a vacancy, which was undisturbed. It is a yogic liberation, and from that posture, without sense of self, without egoity, one simply sees all this play of mental formation, unidentified with it, free of it. So that is one stance. He says further, we can perceive also an occult or subliminal mind in ourselves from which thoughts and perceptions and will impulses and mental feelings arise. Now, this is a layering of mind which is behind the surface mind. If we can look and see that on the surface of things, thoughts sail into us from outside, we can, by being deeply stationed, quiet, silent, vacant of movement, notice that internal to mind's regions, there also is a sea of possibilities which want to express themselves. This is an inner mind. Finally, he writes, we discover that that which observes all this is a mental being supporting the mind substance and mind energy. So this is a kind of personhood, a mental being. Manomaya Purusha. Without this presence, their upholder and source of sanctions, they could not exist or operate. So this entity, this mental being must be there. It suggests, does it not, that it is at the will and behest of this mental being that these thoughts arrive and cohere and are dealt with. This mental being or Purusha first appears as a silent witness. And if that were all, we would have to accept the determinations of mind as a phenomenal activity imposed upon the being by nature, by Prakriti, or else as a creation presented to it by Prakriti, a world of thought which nature constructs and offers to the observing Purusha. So if the Purusha were simply a silent witness, then this play would either be cast upon it by Prakriti, or presented to it, either imposed upon it, sort of a forced servitude upon Purusha by the active nature of Prakriti, or it would be like a show presented. If Purusha were only a silent being. But afterwards, we find that the Purusha, the mental being, can depart from its posture of a silent or accepting witness. It can become the source of reactions, accept, reject, even rule and regulate, become the giver of the command, the knower, Anumanta in Sanskrit, the one who gives the sanction. So, this suggests that the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti is or can be a willed relationship. That rather than Purusha be beset upon by the play of Prakriti, that Purusha, the conscious person, can impose its will on the act of nature and achieve something that it wishes to do. A knowledge also arises, he writes, that this mind substance manifests the mental being, is its own expressive substance, and the mental energy is its own consciousness force, so that it is reasonable to conclude that all mind determinations arise from the being of the Purusha. But wait. But this conclusion is complicated by the fact that from another viewpoint, our personal mind seems to be little more than a formation of universal mind, an engine for the reception, modification, propagation of cosmic thought waves, idea currents, will suggestions, waves of feeling, sense suggestions, form suggestions. It has no doubt its own already realized expression, predispositions, propensities, personal temperament and nature. What comes from the universal can only find a place there if it is accepted and assimilated into the self-expression of the individual mental being, the personal prakriti of the Purusha. So the play of the universe acting upon the individual. Is there a consort of purposes? But still, in view of these complexities, the question remains entire whether all this evolution and action is a phenomenal creation by some universal energy presented to the mental being, or an activity imposed by mind energy on the Purusha's indeterminate, perhaps indeterminable existence, or whether the whole is something predetermined by some dynamic truth of self within and only manifested on the mind surface. So which determines which? To know that, we would have to touch or to enter into a cosmic state of being and consciousness to which the totality of things and their integral principle would be better manifest than to our limited mind experience. So a totalizing awareness is necessary as the key to this, as it was the key to resolving the problem of theodicy. We cannot understand it in part. To be able to see the cosmic purpose as a whole, to be able to see the sense and drift of life in the universe, we have to be as large as the universe. We have to see with a cosmic vision. So we must expand. I think that for one evening we have wrestled enough with metaphysics. We'll put our marks there with your permission, and we'll turn to Savitri. And we're continuing in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. In Canto 5, The Godheads of the Little Life. Not because we insist on being little or living small, but because there is an apposite passage here. At the outset of this enigmatic world, which seems at once an enormous brute machine, and a slow unmasking of the spirit in things, in this revolving chamber without walls, in which God sits impassive everywhere, as if unknown to himself and by us unseen, in a miracle of inconscient secrecy, yet is all here his action and his will. In this whirl and sprawl through infinite vacancy, the spirit became matter and lay in the whirl, a body sleeping without sense or soul. A mass phenomenon of visible shapes, supported by the silence of the void, appeared in the eternal consciousness and seemed an outward and insensible world. There was none there to see and none to feel, only the miraculous inconscient, a subtle wizard skilled, was at its task, inventing ways for magical results, managing creation's marvelous device, marking mechanically dumb wisdom's points, using the unthought, inevitable idea. It did the works of God's intelligence, or wrought the will of some supreme unknown. Still, consciousness was hidden in nature's womb. Unfelt was the bliss whose rapture dreamed the worlds. Being was an inert substance driven by force. Namaste. Jai Ma.